Okay. Do me a favor. Right now, wherever you are, just reach out and knock on the surface in front of you.
Yeah, maybe it's a desk or a table or even the steering wheel of your car.
Right, exactly. Just go ahead and, give it a solid tap.
It makes a sound. It feels hard. It resists your hand.
Yeah, it feels undeniably real.
Yeah.
But here's the question we're going to wrestle with today. And I warn you, it might actually keep you up tonight.
Oh, for sure. It's a heavy one.
Does that table actually exist as a solid material thing, independent of you? Or is it just a collection of ideas being fed directly into your mind?
It is the ultimate red pill question, really. Are we living in a material world or, a mental one?
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're unpacking the philosophy of George Berkeley.
Yeah, famously known as subjective idealism or immaterialism.
Right. And our guide for this journey is a lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes. And look, I know what you're thinking. I know what I was thinking when I first saw this topic.
Yeah, let me guess. There's a no matter. That sounds like dorm room philosophy.
Exactly. It sounds totally ridiculous.
It does. It sounds like something you argue about at like 3 a.m. when you've had way too much caffeine.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Our mission today isn't just to entertain some, trippy idea. We are really going to look at the rigorous logic Berkeley uses.
Because he argues that the word matter is actually meaningless.
Right. And this is the part that actually surprised me, that his view might align better with modern quantum physics than the sort of common sense view we all grew up with.
Which is a bold claim. I mean, you're telling me an 18th century Irish bishop understood the universe better than my high school physics teacher.
In a way, yeah, he kind of did. And Dr. Holmes acknowledges that skepticism right out of the gate. He starts the lecture by admitting that Berkeley's position seems incredibly implausible at first glance.
Because it feels wrong.
Totally. But he says, and this is the hook, if you actually follow the steps of the argument, the plausibility rating improves almost 100%.
100% is a massive jump.
Yeah, it really is.
So let's test that. We have the lecture notes, we have the arguments. Let's see if we can get there. Where does Berkeley even begin? Like, how do you start talking someone out of believing in the physical world?
Well, you have to start with language. Before we talk about tables and chairs, we really have to talk about how we think.
Okay.
Berkeley relies on a concept called nominalism.
All right, let's unpack that. Nominalism.
Essentially, it's the argument that abstract ideas don't actually exist. We think they do, but we only really have specific ideas.
Give me an example of that. What's an abstract idea versus a specific one?
Okay, think of a triangle. Just the
Explain.
concept of a triangle. Don't picture a specific one. Just, picture triangleness.
Okay, I'm trying.
What do you see in your mind?
Well, I'm seeing a shape with three sides. It's kind of a generic equilateral triangle. Black lines, white background.
See? You imagined a specific triangle.
Oh, right.
It had a specific shape, right? Equilateral. It had a specific color, black lines.
Yeah, I guess it did.
Berkeley argues you cannot actually form an idea of a triangle that isn't either right-angled, obtuse, or acute. You can't imagine a triangle that has no color and no specific dimensions.
So, because I can't visualize the concept without visualizing a specific version of it, the abstract idea doesn't actually exist.
Exactly. Words that don't point to specific things are just empty noise to him. And this is where he attacks the word matter.
Right, because matter is supposed to be this, like, general term for stuff.
Correct. It's not a red ball. It's not a wooden table. Those are specific things with qualities we perceive.
Yeah.
Matter is supposed to be the invisible underlying substance that basically holds reality together. But if you strip away all the specific qualities, if it's not red, not hard, not square, not loud, what do you have left?
Nothing. I mean, I can't imagine stuff that isn't some kind of stuff.
And that is the kill shot right there. Dr. Holmes quotes John Locke here. Now, Locke was Berkeley's predecessor, and he actually was a believer in matter. But even Locke admitted that matter is basically, quote, something I know not what. It's just a placeholder word.
A placeholder. Like, we don't know, so we'll just call it matter.
Precisely. So Berkeley looks at that and says, if you don't know what it is, and you can't imagine it, why are we assuming it exists?
Right.
He says that when people argue for the reality of matter, they literally don't know what they are talking about. It's a completely meaningless word.
Okay, that's a clever linguistic trap, though. Just because the word is vague doesn't mean the table in front of me isn't real. I mean, come on. I see the shape, I feel the texture, I can measure it with a ruler.
And that brings us to the second pillar of his argument, and this is where it really gets harder to refute. the distinction between primary and secondary qualities.
This is the Locke idea again.
Yes.
So, Jaelim Locke divided the world into two types of qualities. First, you have secondary qualities. These are things like color, taste, smell, and sound.
Okay.
Most philosophers, even back then, agreed these are subjective. They exist entirely in the observer's mind.
Right. Like the classic example of heat. The heat isn't actually in the fire. The heat is a sensation in my nerves.
Exactly.
Or sweetness. The sweetness isn't in the honey. It's in my tasting of it.
Perfect example. If you have a fever, that same honey might taste bitter. The honey didn't change. Your sensor did.
So the secondary qualities are mental.
Yes. But Locke thought primary qualities, things like shape, size, motion, and solidity, were actually out there. He thought they were physical. They were in the object itself, regardless of who is looking.
And that feels intuitive. A square is a square.
Yeah.
Even if I'm colorblind, the square still has four sides.
But Berkeley destroys this distinction. He asks a very simple question. Can you visualize a primary quality without a secondary quality? Can you visualize a shape without a color?
A shape without color.
Try it. Imagine a square. But it cannot be black, white, red, or even transparent. It can have absolutely no visual contrast against a background.
I can't do it. If I imagine a shape, it has to be visible. And if it's visible, it has to have color or contrast.
Right. And since we just agreed that color is subjective, that it exists only in the mind, then the shape, which you cannot separate from the color, must also be in the mind.
Wait. That's actually really clever. He's saying you can't strip the mental paint off the physical object. They're fused.
They are inseparable. If color is mental and shape can't exist without color, then shape is mental.
Wow.
If heat is mental and motion is often detected through heat or friction, motion collapses too.
So his conclusion is that everything we experience, shape, size, color, sound, it's all in the same bucket. It's all mental.
Correct. Dr. Holmes points out that there is no empirical evidence, no scientific proof whatsoever for a material substratum existing outside of a mind. All we truly know, all we have access to, are minds and ideas.
Okay, I'm following the logic. I can't prove the table exists outside of my perception of it. But here is the massive problem, and Dr. Holmes brings this up immediately in the lecture.
The uniformity problem.
Yeah. If the world is just ideas in my head, why is it so organized? Why can't I control it? Why doesn't the floor disappear when I close my eyes? Why do we all see the same lecture hall? Because honestly, if I'm making this up, I would definitely make myself richer and better looking.
That is the crucial pivot point. This is where Berkeley stops being just a skeptic and starts building his own system. To solve this, he distinguishes between two types of ideas, active ideas and passive ideas.
Let's break those down.
Dr. Holmes uses a very specific, somewhat whimsical example here. He talks about a fairy giraffe with butterfly wings.
A fairy giraffe. Okay, I'm trying to picture that. Pink spots.
Sure, pink spots, giant purple wings. You can picture it, right?
I can. It looks ridiculous, but it's there in my head.
And you are doing that voluntarily. You are constructing that image. You are the cause. That is an active idea.
Yeah.
But now pinch your arm. Like, really pinch it.
Ouch. Okay, done.
Did you choose to feel that specific sensation of pain? Did you craft it artistically like you did the giraffe?
No. I did the action, but the feeling just arrived. It was forced on me.
Exactly. Or open your eyes and look at the room around you. You don't choose to see the walls, the lights, the floor. The data just floods in. These are passive ideas. They are involuntary.
So if I'm not generating them, who is?
That is Berkeley's proof. Ideas cannot exist without a mind. Since you clearly aren't causing these orderly, consistent, shared experiences, and since they're far too complex to be accidents, there must be another mind causing them.
And that mind is?
An infinite spirit or supreme intelligence.
Let me get this straight. The reason the world doesn't vanish when I blink, and the reason gravity works the same for you and me, is that God is essentially broadcasting the world's signal into our consciousness.
That's the model. Dr. Holmes describes nature as a divine language. The order, the predictability, the laws of physics, that is God maintaining a consistent stream of ideas to us. We aren't living in a material world. We are living in God's mind.
That actually makes the world feel distinctively different. It's not just dead stuff. It's a conversation.
It is. And it answers that famous riddle about the tree in the forest. You know the one.
If a tree falls in the forest and no one is around to hear it, does it make a sound?
Yes. Berkeley would say the tree always exists, even if no human is there. Dr. Holmes recites a famous limerick about this in the lecture regarding a tree in the quad.
Oh, I love this one. Lay it on us.
It goes like this. There was a young man who said, God must think it exceedingly odd if he finds that this tree continues to be when there's no one around on the quad.
And the reply.
Dear sir, your astonishment's odd. I'm always in the quad, and that's why the tree will continue to be, since observed by, yours faithfully, God.
That sums it up perfectly. The universe doesn't have a frame rate issue. It doesn't stop rendering when we look away because God is the permanent observer.
Precisely. The world exists endlessly in God's mind.
So that's the setup. God is the broadcaster. We are the receivers. But Dr. Holmes doesn't let Berkeley off the hook that easily. He spends a lot of the lecture handling objections because people always try to poke holes in this. The first one he mentions is hallucinations.
Right, because if I see a pink elephant in the room, is God broadcasting that too? Is God tricking me?
That would make God a pretty unreliable narrator.
Exactly. Dr. Holmes suggests Berkeley would call a hallucination a mental malfunction. It's actually closer to that fairy trap. Is your imagination gone wrong? Or a glitch in your specific receiver.
Gotcha.
It lacks the coherence, the vividness, and the shared nature of the real world God provides.
So if I see the pink elephant, but you don't, and I can't touch it, it's just a local glitch.
Correct. It's not part of the divine language.
That makes sense. But then we get to the heavy hitter, the one that stops most religious philosophies in their tracks, the problem of evil.
Yes. This is a major hurdle for idealism.
Because think about it. If there is matter, I can blame a tornado on wind pressure. I can blame cancer on rogue cells or genetics. Nature is just nature.
Right.
But if there is no matter, if everything is a passive idea fed to us directly by God, then isn't God directly causing the cancer? Isn't God essentially handcrafting the sensation of pain and feeding it to me?
It creates a very direct link between God and suffering. It's a profound theological puzzle. And Dr. Holmes explains Berkeley's defense, which relies on the greater good argument.
Greater good. That's a phrase that usually precedes some bad news. What does it mean here?
Basically, that a fixed, predictable order of nature is essential for human life. We need to know that fire burns. Hmm. We need to know that gravity pulls. We need biology to be consistent.
Right. Because if fire didn't burn me today, but burn me tomorrow, I couldn't learn anything. I couldn't cook. I couldn't forge metal.
Exactly. Without that predictability, we couldn't do science. We couldn't make plans. We couldn't essentially be human. So the particular inconveniences, as Berkeley politely calls them.
Which is a very mild way of saying agony and death.
Very British, yes. But those inconveniences are the cost of having a predictable universe.
I see.
Holmes adds another layer too, referencing Locke again. Pain acts as a pedagogue, a teacher. It's a warning system. Pain teaches us how to survive. It teaches us limits. If you didn't feel pain when you touched a hot stove, you'd lose your hand.
Okay, I can buy that for natural evil. Tornadoes and fires are part of the physics engine. But what about moral evil? What about when a person does something terrible to another person?
The lecture uses a very specific example here. A professor threatening to give a student named Christine an F purely out of malice.
Okay, so the professor's just being a jerk. He's sinning.
Right. Now, in Berkeley's world, the physical F on the paper is an idea from God. So did God write the F? Is God participating in the malice?
That is the trap.
Berkeley's answer is nuanced. He separates the will from the effect. The sin is the active idea in the professor's mind, his malicious will. That is the evil. That belongs entirely to the professor.
And the red ink on the paper.
That is God coordinating the passive effect to maintain the consistency of the natural order. God allows the effect, the sight of the F, so that reality remains consistent for everyone involved. If God just blocked the F from appearing, the laws of the universe would be broken.
So God maintains the server rules, even when the players are breaking the code of conduct.
That is a surprisingly accurate analogy. The platform holds up, even if the users misuse it.
Now, earlier you teased that this philosophy, which sounds so mystical, actually connects to modern science. Usually we think of immaterialism as anti-science. Dr. Holmes argues Berkeley fits well with quantum physics.
He calls it the dematerialization of matter. You see, in the 18th century, everyone believed in Newtonian physics. They thought the world was made of hard, solid, indivisible pellets called atoms, little billiard balls.
Right. Inert stuff, dead matter hitting dead matter.
But move forward to the 20th century. Einstein, quantum mechanics, E equals mc squared. What did we learn?
We learn that matter isn't really solid at all. It's energy. It's vibrating fields. If you zoom in on an atom, it's mostly empty space and probability clouds.
Exactly. The concept of solid matter has largely evaporated from high-level physics. Holmes points out that Berkeley's rejection of inert stuff aligns surprisingly well with the idea that the universe is made of activity and energy, not solid pellets.
So Berkeley was right. just for the wrong reasons.
Or perhaps he was just ahead of the curve in realizing that solidity is an illusion of perception. He stripped away the stuff and left the activity. Modern physics did the same thing, just with more math.
That is wild. Makes you wonder what else these old philosophers guessed right. Okay, there is one specific theological puzzle for the text I want to touch on, because it feels like a gotcha question for a bishop. The incarnation.
Ah, yes.
Because if matter isn't real, was Jesus real? Did he have a body? Or was he just a ghost?
Holmes addresses this directly. The answer is yes, he was real. Because remember, in this theory, flesh isn't some magical distinct substance. Flesh is a specific set of passive ideas, visuals, textures, sensations.
So did Jesus feel pain? Did he get hungry?
Yes, he experienced the full range of passive ideas. He was plugged into the same matrix of sensations that we are. That confirms his humanity.
So the fact that his body was mental rather than material doesn't make it any less real, because our bodies are mental too.
Precisely. It changes nothing about the experience of the incarnation, only the metaphysical explanation of what underlies it.
Okay, one last puzzle before we move on. This one bothers me personally. Other minds.
The solipsism fear.
Exactly. If I only perceive my own ideas, how do I know you exist? I can't see your mind. I can only see your body. And we've already established that your body is just an idea in my head. Are you just a non-playable character generated by God to keep me company?
This is the problem of other minds. Holmes explains Berkeley's solution as an argument by analogy.
Walk us through that.
It goes like this. I have a mind and I have a body. I know that when I have a thought, say, I want to wave my hand, my body moves. My will causes a physical change in the idea of my body.
Okay, simple enough.
Now I look at you. I see your body acting very much like mine. You speak, you move, you react to things logically. You wince if you stub your toe.
So I look at the evidence and say, hey, that thing over there is acting like me.
Right. I infer that there must be a mind behind your body, just like there is a mind behind mine. It's an analogy.
It's a logical leap, though. I can't prove it.
No, you can't. And Holmes notes a critique here. We don't usually walk around doing logical proofs to decide if our friends are real. We just recognize them. Mm-hmm. But logically, for Berkeley, the analogy is the bridge. It saves us from being alone in the universe.
All right, so we have a complete system here. A world of minds, ideas, and God keeping it all steady. It's tight. It works. But the lecture doesn't end with Berkeley. Dr. Holmes transitions to the next big figure in British empiricism, David Hume. And from what I gathered, Hume is the party pooper.
He really is. Holmes uses Hume to show the progression of thought, and it's a bit of a tragic progression. You start with Locke, who is a dualist. He believes in both mind and matter.
Okay.
Then you get Berkeley, who is a mentalist. He deletes matter, keeps the mind, and God.
And Hume.
Hume is a skeptic. He argues we can't really know the reality of mind or matter. He takes the very tools Berkeley used to destroy matter and turns them against the mind and God.
So he tears it all down.
Completely. Hume argues that we know no matter's effect beyond our immediate experience. We have appearances phenomena, but we can't prove there is a God. We can't prove there is a self holding our memories together. We can't even prove that gravity is a necessary law. We just know it's happened so far.
This is phenomenalism. Just stuff happening, no cause, no meaning.
Right. But Holmes highlights a fascinating distinction Hume makes between psychology and logic. Hume argues that while we can't prove reality logically, we believe it psychologically because we are human. We can't help but believe.
That famous quote, be a philosopher, but amidst all your philosophy, be still a man.
Exactly. We run on instinct, not proof. We leave the lecture hall and we open the door because we believe the door is there, not because we can prove it.
This skepticism hits ethics hard too, doesn't it?
It does. If we can't know human nature, how do we know what is right or wrong? Holmes explains that for Hume, ethics becomes ethical subjectivism.
Which means it's all about feelings.
Yes. If I say murder is wrong, I'm not identifying a universal truth. I'm expressing a sentiment. I'm basically saying, ouch, I don't like that, or that makes me feel bad.
That is a slippery slope. We went from Berkeley's God-centered matrix, where everything has meaning and is a direct word from the creator, to Hume's world, where we can't know anything but our own fleeting feelings.
That is the history of philosophy in a nutshell. One idea leading inevitably to the next, often dismantling the previous one. Berkeley handed Hume the weapon empiricism, and Hume used it to dismantle everything.
So let's wrap this up. We have unpacked Berkeley's world. It's a world where matter is a myth, and reality is a direct interface between our finite minds and the infinite mind.
It is a view that forces you to question the very nature of evidence. Even if you don't accept Berkeley's conclusion, his challenge stands. What evidence do you actually have for a material world that isn't just an idea in your head? You can't point to anything that exists outside of perception.
And here is the thought I want to leave you with today. Even if you aren't ready to sell your house and become an immaterialist, try on Berkeley's glasses for an hour.
What do you mean?
If Berkeley is right, if this isn't just a clockwork universe running on its own, but a divine language being spoken to us in real time, then look at your day again.
Every sensation. The warmth of your coffee, the sound of traffic, the blue of the sky.
If Berkeley is right, every single one of those things is a direct personal communication from the Creator to you. It's not just background noise. It's a text message from God. Does that change how you view the boring parts of your day?
It certainly makes the mundane feel a lot more miraculous.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive into George Berkeley. Keep asking questions, and we'll see you on the next one.